Welcome into the Wednesday edition of Big Noon Sports, presented by Haley Sansing, Union Home Mortgages, Matt and Lars, as you just mentioned, and Justin Jones is our producer for the final time as he is going to exit and go on to what we hope are greener pastures. And we will talk at length with Justin and what a great contributor he has been into this show a little bit later in Big Noon Sports. First of all, let's welcome in Lars, who is currently cutting his yard.
Yes, I apologize. Hopefully it will be done here shortly. College football playoff rankings came out yesterday, Matt, after our show. And were you surprised by anything? We got Ohio State. Just went down on me, of course.
Ohio State, Georgia, Michigan, Florida State, Washington, all of which are undefeated. Then you've got one loss Oregon, one loss Texas, one loss Alabama, one loss Ole Miss, and one loss Penn State. You know, Lars, about 4 or 5 months ago, you said there's a real chance that Alabama could not make the playoffs. And I kind of went, harumph. Winner of the SEC championship game should go to the playoffs. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, Alabama, like they did about 10 years ago, has got to have some things happen in front of them. They are not in control of their own destiny, and that seems difficult. The team we saw beat LSU. But I've learned that I have to accept the fact that's a real possibility. Now, it's likely at least two of these teams are going to end up playing each other, right? But even in a loss, is Ohio State going to drop that far? If Michigan happens to beat them, vice versa. I don't see Georgia losing. Florida State might, but I don't think that their schedule is all that tough, including a championship game. So Alabama is obviously, Lars, they need help, right?
Yes, they do. I'm sorry. I've got so much stuff going on in my house right now. It's unbelievable. But, Alabama needs some help. There's no question about it, because if Washington runs the table, they're going to be in. If Michigan or Ohio State runs the table, they're going to be in. If Florida State runs the table, they're going to be in. If Texas then ends up winning the Big Ten championship, the Big 12 championship, is there any argument that can be made to put Alabama in over Texas? I guess you could. I mean, Texas' lone loss is against Oklahoma, and Oklahoma has just fallen flat on its face. In the eye test, you certainly would think if Alabama and Texas were to play on a neutral field right now, that Alabama would be favored. But, you know, I think what trumps everything is the fact that Texas came into Tuscaloosa on a Saturday night in September and beat them pretty handily. And so I think it was, what, the first double-digit loss at home of Nick Saban's tenure at Alabama? I think it's something like some crazy stat like that. So, unfortunately, you know, Alabama just has to – at this point, Alabama needs help. But usually these things have a way of working themselves out. And who knows how Texas, if they continue to not look great and they are not playing as well as they were when they visited Tuscaloosa, and a big part of that is their quarterback, Quinn Ewers, is hurt. And Alabama is obviously playing a lot better. But it's just going to be so hard if it comes down to Alabama and Texas, and that's got to be the biggest fear of Alabama fans. It's just hard to make that argument that you put Alabama in over the Longhorns based on head-to-head competition at Bryant Denny.
Yeah, it's tough. I think the only argument you could really make right now is perhaps Oregon, because of strength of schedule. Their record is the same as Alabama, but I think if Oregon and Washington meet, that Oregon's going to win that game, and then, yeah, man, what happens?
Alabama would get in over Oregon, and so that in that scenario, you know, we've been talking about the Pac-12 all season long, about how surprisingly in their last year of existence, they had emerged as the strongest conference and with the most depth. And I still think you could make that argument. And it's very possible that the teams just cannibalize themselves, because I think a one-loss Pac-12 champion does not get in over a one-loss SEC champion, meaning
right now,
Alabama.
Oregon is there.
I know, but Alabama beating Georgia in the SEC championship game, it'd be based on how that game would be played out. I think Alabama would leapfrog Oregon. But again, Oregon's going to have to play Washington most likely in the Pac-12 championship. So who knows? There's a lot to that still will, I think, will take care of itself. But there are some scenarios out there where Alabama, even if they win out, they will not make it in.
It's probably a small thing, and it is going to work its way out, because obviously two teams in front of Washington, Ohio State and Michigan, are going to play, and a loss there would drop them below Washington. But right now I think I'd have Washington at 4 and Florida State at 5. But I think that is a scenario, Lars, that is absolutely going to play its way out. But we'll see. It's not an enviable position for Alabama, because of what I've said now three times, is that they're not in control. They can win out impressively and then, you know, possibly beat Georgia. It's hard to imagine an SEC champion not being in the top four at the end of the year. And then what happens with Georgia if they lose a game, you know? Do they drop all the way out of the top four? I would guess so. And you could give some evidence that Georgia hadn't really played outstanding, but hey, guess what? They are undefeated. They have won, 27 in a row now? So I wonder what kind of consideration you give a team that comes into the season an undefeated two-time champion. So we'll see how it works out, but it's going to be kind of dicey here over the next couple of weeks. We'll just see what happens.
Yeah, and boy, it really would have helped out Alabama if Kansas State had won that game in overtime against Texas this last weekend, then that issue would be resolved.
Let me ask you something. Excuse me for interrupting. Let me ask you something straight up, Lars. If things just continue to be the same, does Texas stay in front of Alabama?
Yeah.
I think so, too. It's
unfortunately,
I do, too. Alabama would beat Texas.
They're two completely different teams.
Alabama suffered a double-digit home loss. But, hey, congratulations. Texas won by double digits at Bryant-Denny Stadium. So I think that will keep Texas in front of Alabama unless they suffer a loss here. But it's fun to play around with. This is one of those topics that really fuel talk radio and now podcasts like ours. And then all the talk on social media.
Another question is, what if Penn State beats Michigan this weekend? And really, what is the game of the weekend, along with Georgia hosting Ole Miss? Ole Miss is up to 9, so which actually helps Alabama, the fact that Ole Miss is so high. But what happens if Penn State beats Michigan? And then Michigan beats Ohio State. You have 3 1-loss teams in the Big Ten.
And one of them is ranked number one in the power rankings, and that's Ohio State.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually.
How does the number one team drop 5-6 places? Well, I think that's what they would.
I was surprised that the committee put Ohio State above Georgia, because Georgia beats a very good Missouri team. Granted, it wasn't the prettiest game in the world, but Ohio State really struggled against a Rutgers team that is not that wonderful. But they played good in the second half. So I guess that was enough for the committee to keep Ohio State at 1. But, if you're an Alabama fan, you're rooting for anyone and everyone who plays Florida State. But it looks like Florida State has a pretty clear path to me to making it into the Final Four, especially based on the way they're playing.
As we go out, is Florida State a top four team? Do they belong at four?
Probably, based on who they've beaten.
I think Washington belongs there. But again, you know what, Lars? That's going to play itself out.
Yeah.
We just don't know. I can't wait for these games, particularly this weekend, to see what happens. Hey, you're listening to Big Noon Sports. It's Lars, Matt, and Justin. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you the extraordinary story about the longest pass in football history. That's coming up on Big Noon Sports.
Thompson is known as the Bama Broker. She's a Tuscaloosa native, an Alabama graduate, and the only realtor in town with Wall Street experience. A skilled negotiator, Laura Lee knows how to buy low and sell high. And the Bama Broker isn't just going to show you houses. No, Laura Lee is going to educate you on the market, guide you to homes that fit your budget, and teach you how to sell your home for its maximum profit. Throughout the entire process, the Bama Broker will equip you with the tools you need to both buy a home and build financial wealth through home ownership. Trust me, the Bama Broker, who's as roll tide as houndstooth, will get you across the goal line. That's Laura Lee Thompson, the Bama Broker with Advantage Realty Group. You can reach her at 205-790-7229. Again, that's 205-790-7229. And you can also email her at lauralee@thebamabroker.com. That's lauralee@thebamabroker.com.
Tide 100.9, Tuscaloosa weather.
The weather unseasonably warm this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, the high 82. For tonight, mostly fair with a low at 59. Tomorrow, clouds gradually increasing. We'll have a chance of showers by tomorrow night, the daytime high 79. I'm James Spann of the ABC 3340 Weather Center on Tide 100.9. It's 81 degrees in Tuscaloosa.
From T-Town to the Plains, this is Alabama's most in-depth analysis on the SEC. This is Big Noon Sports.
Hey, we're back on Big Noon Sports. Man, Lars, today, as opposed to 81 yesterday, today it is a more crisp and fall-like afternoon, and that doesn't stop the lawn work, does it?
It's not that much
crisper.
Actually,
it did for now.
Yeah.
It's about 69 right now.
Yeah, it does not feel like fall football weather right now. It feels like August, last days of August.
I saw a story this morning on AL.com. Mark Heim seems to be able to pick these things off, and he is often a guest on the show. And this one is a real doozy. It's a story that comes from the memoirs in a book published by Katie Britt, who is now the U.S. Senator. Her husband, Wesley Britt, played at Alabama, and unfortunately, they were victims of the 2011 tornadoes. And she writes in her book, and Mark Heim picks off some of the quotes in this story, that they found part of their belongings, like a picture, a family photo of the Brits was found in Rainbow City, which is 100 miles away. Her law notes. Can you imagine being in law school and having all your law notes just tossed?
That's tough.
Yeah, that's tough. And so as the story continues, there's a football that was found 10 miles away from her home. And it was a cherished family, you know, souvenir, collectible. And it was found 10 miles. So that's the longest pass I've ever heard. You ever heard anybody throw one? A tornado can throw a football 10 miles and more. And that's a really cool, but it was returned to the Bryant Museum where it was on display, and Wesley Britt saw it and said, hey, I believe that's our family's. But here's what makes the story just incredible. I mean, you're talking about the world working in a circle and through the hands of God. Do you know who found the football and put it in the Bryant Museum? Cecil Hurt.
Unbelievable.
That's just an incredible story. And it just goes to, I guess, the karma that can sometimes happen even in a disaster like the tornadoes of Tuscaloosa in 2011. But also good people. Her wallet was tossed somewhere tens of 20 miles away.
Yeah, halfway across
somebody
the state.
Somebody returned it with $20. Said, we hope you're all right. Here's your wallet. Yeah, there's some good people left in this world, Lars Anderson.
Yeah, and it'll be really interesting. I look forward to reading her book, and it's called God Calls Us to Do Hard Things, Lessons from the Alabama Wiregrass. And you know, my politics don't align with Katie's, but I certainly appreciate her, and think she's doing a really good job for the state of Alabama. And I think she's going to have that seat for as long as she wants it, basically. But this is just—it's a really. It reads just according to the story again by Mark Heim that Katie really gets personal about you know, her time at the University of Alabama and her experiences in Tuscaloosa, and especially on that day and on April 27th, 2011. I'm you know what's even more impressive about this, Matt, is I don't think Cecil ever wrote about this.
I don't think so either.
At least I never heard about it. And certainly, you know, in all my research for The Storm and the Tide, if I had known about this story, I certainly would have put it in the book. And so the fact that Cecil kept it, kept it private, I think speaks to his character.
Well, it does, and nobody knows. Well, I guess there are some that know a little bit more, maybe not, about what happened in Tuscaloosa back in 2011, because your book was a New York Times bestseller in The Storm of the Tide. So kudos to all and all their memoirs and all their notes, and I just thought that was story. Because I remember, Lars, when I was very, very young, it's the first major story I ever covered. I think I was 15 years old in Huntsville. And, you know, the 73 tornadoes that came through North Alabama were, they were tragic. I don't know as far as lives lost if it was equal to the day in 2011. But I remember reading later that they found a check that somebody had written in Guin, Alabama, in Huntsville, Alabama. And as the crow flies, I think that's probably about 75 miles. And it was, I think, at that point in my life I realized how absolutely ferocious tornadoes could be to take something, you know, paper-like, because it is paper, mm-hmm. and twirl it around for 75 miles and then just, you know, drop it in somebody's driveway.
This
is not an unusual story as far as finding personal items hundreds of miles away.
I mean, just in my lawn, I was living in Homewood at the time. Paper with markings from Tuscaloosa ended up in my yard, and our buddy Kerry Estes in Birmingham, he literally in his front yard, he saw a. Because the tornado passed about, 10 miles north of Birmingham, or really maybe right. five. And, but a car battery fell from the sky into Carrie's yard in Birmingham. Car battery.
It's a pretty heavy item.
Yeah.
Heavier than a football and a check for darn sure.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Carrie Estes found a battery.
Yeah. In his yard. Who knows where that battery came from? I mean, one would suspect that, you know, A car battery is not light. I don't know.
Came from down the street, it shows you what these beasts can do.
Yeah. Oh man, just the ferocity, 190 mile an hour winds. It's
a fantastic story, and then it is literally topped by the fact that longtime writer, Hall of Fame journalist Cecil Hurt found it.
Yeah.
There's something very appropriate about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so many stories from that day. So many stories. And it's not just Tuscaloosa, as we know. There's so many other communities that were devastated that day. I worry about the collective memory is starting to fade. At least from my perspective, in being in Tuscaloosa, the current students were so young when this event happened. You know, they were 10 years old. And the majority, as you spoke to my class last night and saw for yourself, the majority of my students are from out of state. So they don't know anything about April 27th, 2011. And I've been a little surprised by some decisions that have been made by the school about, you know, when to call off class, when not to, based on what the radar is saying. And it's just, I've talked to some other people at the university and they've been a little perplexed too, just because, you know, for the people who lived through it, and especially for the people who lost everything. And there are so many of those people still in Alabama, still affiliated with the university, that every time there's a warning, it's like post-traumatic stress kind of settles in. It's not the case for me, because I wasn't, you know, personally impacted the way so many others were. But it's just my sense that the collective sort of consciousness of that day is fading too fast.
Well, and I'm not going to get too deep, but I think that that's very much true in the case of 9/11 too. Of course, that was 22 years ago, but I don't think America has the same soul it did back then, and that's about all I'm going to say about that. All right, coming up, we're going to talk to our college football guy, all things football. Steve Irvine will be joining us, and of course he'll give us a rundown on some college basketball as well. And then at 1 o'clock this afternoon, Brian Crichton will be joining us, Talladega Super Speedway chairman, and he will talk about Ryan Blaney being the champion of the Cup Series, and then also about something you can do this Saturday that ought to thrill the kids. And I've done it. You should do it. You're listening to Big Noon Sports, presented by Haley Sansing, Union Home Mortgage.
From T-Town to the Plains, this is Alabama's most in-depth analysis on the SEC. This is Big Noon Sports.
Many of our select interviews are brought to you by Laura Lee Thompson, the Bama broker, Advantage Realty Group, and she will be with us, as always, during the football season. She will be with us Friday at Innis Free Irish Pub, right there on University 25 years, Tuscaloosa's best bar. Lars, Matt, Justin, and now joined by one of our regulars, very generous with his time. It's the one and only Steve Irvine. Steve, how are things on this Wednesday afternoon with you?
Oh, everything's going great, man. Just driving home from football practice at UAB and just enjoying the day.
What are they doing?
Oh, they practice in the morning, man. They I love it, man. They get up and they practice in the morning, and interviews about, I don't know, I usually interview around 11:30 or so, and get on home, man. So I like that. I think everybody should do that.
Hey, Steve, yesterday, Matt and I, we were talking with our buddy Walt Williams, and he was telling us about Harrison Barker getting some action, yeah. Jay's son. Tell us just a little bit about Harrison, and apparently it suffered an injury, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, it was really a great story. You know, the starting quarterback, Jacob Zeno, had a concussion and was unable to play. So they came up with a plan to play three different quarterbacks. This is last week against Memphis. And Harrison was three on the depth chart, but they started him. You know, they just figured it with what they wanted to do at first. They started him, and he threw a touchdown pass on his, I think it was the fourth play of the game. First drive, touchdown pass, beautiful pass and a kind of a fade pattern to the to a receiver in the corner of the end zone, and just really, really played well during the game. All three of them did. Gave them a chance to win. You know, they was 21-21 at half, and a lot of it was because the quarterbacks were playing well. Unfortunately, he had a concussion in the game, and wasn't able to finish. But he's back out now playing. And you know, I think they gained some confidence in him and the other guys that if something happens again, they'll give it another shot, you know. And so, but it was fun to watch. It really was.
What makes that story even cooler? I mean, you know, his dad, obviously, national championship quarterback, you know, Alabama Hall of Fame. We all know Jay. Many of us know him very, very well, consider him a good friend. But Jay posted the video of when Harrison was awarded his scholarship, and that was less than a year ago, and that's pretty cool. And I guess that just enlightens the whole story. Is it just progression day by day on the concussion protocol?
Yeah, well, he's fine now. He's back in practice now. I think, you know, because that was 2 weeks ago now, so he I'm not sure. I don't remember if he dressed last week or not, to be honest with you, but he didn't get a chance to play, but yeah, he's fine. I mean, he's fine. And, you know, again, I think that moving forward, that shows, you know, that he can do a job. And actually his scholarship was actually during fall camp, you know, when he was awarded a scholarship. Yeah. So that you're talking about, I mean, that's what, 2 months ago or whatever it was, 3 months, whatever it was. And that was a neat little deal too when he got that. So, but it's been fun to watch him. And you know, I tell you, you don't really notice it, you know, maybe from the outside, but he has played such a key role with he's one of their signal guys. He sends the signals in, and they've talked a lot about how, because he knows football so well, that he's really been more than just a guy sending in signals. So he can see things at times when he's, you know, before he signals in and that type of thing. So he's played a key role. It just hadn't—you just really hadn't seen it every day, that type of thing.
Yeah, and he has an understanding of the game, unlike a few others, just because of his dad and always being around it. But let's just sort of zoom out, or just take a wider look, camera look, angle look at Trent Dilfer. Yeah. And you know, he was a national story coming into the season. Now we're about two-thirds of the way or so through the season. Just give us your assessment of Trent Dilfer and just how you think he's done this year in adjusting to being a head coach at the college level for the first time and guiding this Blazer program.
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly he's done a good job. I think it has been a learning process, and I don't know that he was quite, and I don't know that he quite understood how much a learning process it was going to be. You know, I think that he had built that, that high school program in a short time into such a power. And, you know, I think there was part of him that thought it was going to be the same thing. And it's not. I mean, as we all know, it's not. And so I think he's taken a lot of steps, you know, as a head coach. I think that, there'll be some things that he does different moving forward, and there'll be some things he does the same moving forward. But, you know, I think for it's hard to put a grade on it, you know, especially when it's such a bottom line and such a, you know, wins and losses sort of, business, that sometimes you lose sight of, you don't see progression. And, you know, if you don't see it on the scoreboard And but I've seen a lot of progression from him, and they, you know, they changed some things and, you know, on the fly type thing. And, but I, you know, I think he's done well. I mean, you know, the other thing that it was doing that none of us did, including myself, is we didn't really analyze well that, you know, just how many, that there were some holes here. Sometimes that's tough to do, you know, personnel wise. Sometimes that's tough to do when all you see is them against each other, because you see, you know, if there's a hole somewhere that you know that they're going against, and they're really good in this area, well, that might be because they're not so good in the other area that they're going against. So I think there was a little bit of that too. And I do think this. I think this has to be mentioned when you're talking about his first year, kind of his first year assessment, is he purposely did not come in and try to tear this thing up. He came in and I think he knew that there could be some lumps, but I think he wanted to give, you know, give everybody here kind of an honest chance type of thing about, okay, well, I think that, you know, I think I'm going to give these, you know, I'm going to give it a year and I'm going to build and I'm going to bring in some high school kids and let them, you know, let them progress over a year. So he could have come in, he could have blown it up, he could have hit the portal hard, he could have hit JUCO hard. And he didn't do that. And I think that was purposeful. I think it was. And so I commend him for that. I really do.
By the way, our guest is Steve Irvine with Magic City Impact. It's the official NIL collective of UAB. Let's switch gears quickly to UAB and Bradley Monday night. Really odd game because Bradley had UAB 40-24 at the half. Well, UAB flips it, and I mean exactly. UAB outscores Bradley in the second half, 40-24. So they go to overtime. The Braves end up winning 73-71. Is that more, this difficult question, is that more because UAB's just not ready, or is Bradley that good?
Well, I think it's two good teams. I mean, I really do, and I kind of am going to go both ways on this. I don't know if UAB's ready, but I think it's also two good teams. And I think there was, you know, again, you talk about purposeful. I mean, Andy Kennedy and I think Brian Wardle, Bradley both, I think they both wanted a game like that. Maybe not as crazy as it was, but I think they really wanted to be pushed to see where they were, you know, and there's a lot of questions that, you know, that came out of that game for Andy Kennedy about, you know, moving forward, you know, certain guys and that type of thing. But I think it was, I think in the long run, you're going to see it was a good game for both teams. It's a heck of a lot better if you win that thing. But it was, you know, I think you're going to learn a lot. It's a lot better than just rolling it out there and, you know, and playing, you know, somebody that you're going to beat by a lot and then you don't have any. Yeah. I mean, do something like that. And you know, and UAB's got to go play Clemson on Friday. And if they win, and then they'll play either Davidson or Maryland after that. So, he wanted this to answer some questions before they went into that.
And last night, a really good basketball game. Baylor, Auburn kind of blew a lead, or Baylor just got hot, but they won that thing 88-92. And the Tigers were up 11 at the half. But anyway, who wants to play basketball in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Yikes. Hey, let's talk Alabama basketball.
Now, my parents are from South Dakota.
There you go.
I just can't imagine.
And I've stayed many a night in Sioux Falls. It's lovely.
Have you really?
There you go. It's beautiful. It really is a beautiful place.
The Holodome.
When we get back, we'll the what? Is that the basketball arena?
Holiday? No. Holiday Inn. Holiday. Remember when you were little and Holiday Inns had Holodomes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's
there's one in South Dakota, in Sioux Falls. Sorry,
everything in Sioux Falls is indoors, isn't it? hey, let's talk some Alabama basketball and college football when we get back on Big Noon Sports with Steve Irvine.
If you fish.
Tide 100.9, Tuscaloosa weather.
The weather unseasonably warm this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, the high 82. For tonight, mostly fair with a low at 59. Tomorrow, clouds gradually increasing. We'll have a chance of showers by tomorrow night, the daytime high 79. I'm James Spann on the ABC 3340 Weather Center on Tide 100.9. It's 81 degrees in Tuscaloosa.
More Big Noon Sports coming up.
Indeed it is. And our guest from Magic City Impact is Steve Irvine. Steve, Alabama opened up with a huge win over Morehead State. And the transfer portal has been very, very good to Nate Oates because he's learned to work it. There'll be a drop-off because there's no Brandon Miller, but there's Grant Nelson. Whoa. You had a chance to look into and figure out what's going on in Alabama, because it seems to me like Nate Oates is locked in to just produce teams like this every year. He knows how to work the transfer portal, doesn't he?
Boy, he does. I mean, he does. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, this day and age, you know, particularly in college basketball a little more, because you don't need to, you know, you don't need to get a whole lot of them. I mean, you can have two or three probably that then really make an impact. And you can a little bit in football, depending on who those two or three are. But, you know, in football, you have to have a little more to make a huge impact. But you know, with this, I mean, you bring in a Grant Nelson, you know, I mean, and that changes things. I mean, it really does. I mean, it's, you know, Aaron Estrada. I mean, just different guys you get, you know, that you can come and you can fill a hole, so to speak, of guys that left, or you can bring something new type thing. But Grant Nelson, I was really looking forward to seeing him play. I was very impressed. You know, he's a guy. Obviously, he's a matchup guy. He's got a matchup problem for people. And so I think that, you know, certainly you build around him and some other guys.
Yeah, and I think really impressive performance by Alabama right out of the gate. All right, let's switch gears and go to Crimson Tide football. And just the transformation of Jalen Milroe from not playing at all against South Florida, you know, struggling against Texas, and then basically being benched in the South Florida game, to what we saw on Saturday night, which was just an absolutely electrifying player.
And the amazing thing is, and you would never, I mean, I don't know if you would never, but it was hard to say this early in the year that you would ever think he was going to be looked like a polished football player this year. I mean, you really, you know, because there's just such struggle early on, and but man, he's polished. I mean, it's not just an athlete running around out there like he kind of was early in the year. I mean, he's polished. You know, just such a playmaker. Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, and the other thing that, I mean, Lars, if you think about it, would we have ever said that he's a Heisman Trophy candidate, you know, early in the year? I mean, come on.
Talk to Matt Coulter. we talked to Matt Coulter about this, please.
Oh, no, Steve, earlier in the week, Lars mentioned that, and I went, he's not going to win a Heisman, and he is.
Come on!
I kind of went on. To Pashaw. I went to Pashaw way on it, and then like 15 minutes later, he found an article, and he's 10th in the voting now. So,
every single guest we've had, I think even Brando mentioned Milroe and Heisman in the same breath. I mean,
who knows?
You have to. You have to mention the way the Heisman is set up and the way he's played as the season's progressed, you have to mention him as a Heisman candidate right now. Now, I'm not saying he's the number one guy, but you know what? If we're sitting here after the SEC championship game and Alabama's 12-1 and he's played like he's playing right now the remainder of the way, then you're crazy if you don't think he's a candidate at that point. You know what I'm saying? I mean, yes, there's work left.
Have you seen this happen before, Steve, where one game just absolutely changes the national perception of one player?
I can't think of it. You know, I mean, there's been times maybe you could think of it the opposite way where somebody's, you know, they're talking about somebody as a candidate and then they have a really bad game and they sort of fall off. But I, boy, that's maybe if we sit down and really brainstorm it, there might be somebody that you could say that about. But off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody that that is overnight type thing almost as nationally as now. But I think it's more than overnight if you really look at it, obviously. But nationally, sometimes it takes a game like that to see. I just think if you go back and really look at his progression, it's been amazing. It really has. And honestly, I mean, it's easy to say now, hindsight and all that kind of stuff, but I think the best thing that happened to him was probably South Florida, you know, and yeah. That where it was taken away from. And I think that's probably what they were doing, you know. I mean, I really do. And not just for him, but just for the team, sort of a refocus sort of thing. You know, and they got through it, and that's good. But I don't know. Like I say, I thought in my head, I can't think of anything right now.
Do you think Alabama could go toe-to-toe with anybody in the nation right now?
Yes, I do. Because I think this. I think that when you are used to finding ways to win, like they had to do, really all season long, I think you can go toe-to-toe with anybody. I really do. When you have that, when there's, it doesn't always have to be pretty, and it hadn't always been pretty. There's no doubt. But I think when you get that mindset in you, you're going to find a way. Now, it might not be the same way every week, but you're going to find a way. And I kind of think that's where this team is right now.
Do you think this game on Saturday against Kentucky, Alabama, I think right now is at a 10-point favorite. And Alabama's not played in Lexington in a decade. And so I this is a really big deal to people in Kentucky. Do you think this is a dangerous game for Alabama?
I think so. And I think a lot of it is coming off, you know, beating LSU and just everything that went on with that. There's a little bit of, you know, there's got to be a little bit of letdown, I would think. And you know, this is Kentucky's last home game. You know, they So it's a senior. I'm sure it's senior night, but I'm sure it's senior night and or senior day, whatever. And so I think that there's a little bit of that. But I just think, you know, I like the way Alabama's playing right now, and I think they'll be able to overcome that. But I think you do have to, and I'm sure there'll be some things they do this week to make sure that the focus stays where it should be. But it is a little bit dangerous going into that, you know. Just looking from the outside, it seems a little bit dangerous right now.
Our guest is Steve Irvine from Magic City Impact with UAB's NIL, the collective. Let's go back to the Heisman Trophy. Who'd get your vote right now?
Oh, boy. Probably Michael Penix, probably. I don't know. I mean, you know, I haven't really looked close enough to you know, say, hey, these are my top three. But, you know, I like what they've done and what he's done. So that might be my guy right now, you know. But, you know, we got a little bit, you know, and you know me, I've said a long time before, I don't like to make predictions. I don't like to, you know, to me, I want to see body of work, you know. I'm talking about the whole body of work before I really say for sure who I think, but right now maybe him.
Yeah, and I think Bo Nix is right there, and Oregon is playing really well, and I wouldn't be surprised if Penix and Nix meet in the Pac-12 championship game. Winner of that game potentially goes to college football playoff. And like we said in round one, when it was Washington, Oregon, like this is going to go a long way to determine who is going to be the front runner for the Heisman. And if there is a rematch, I really think that game could determine who wins or who loses, not just the Pac-12, but also the Heisman Trophy.
Yeah. And I totally agree. And then, you know, you think back to that game and, you know, Oregon outplayed Washington that day. You know, Oregon should be the one sitting here right now with, you know, undefeated and, you know, just didn't kick the field goals. And, you know, just, you know, I really thought that Oregon outplayed them that day. And I thought Bo Nix really played well. But, you know, hey, It is what it is.
I don't get Dan. I just didn't get Dan Lanning and that the field goal fiasco. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of analytics.
No, I'm not either. And the thing is, I mean, you're sitting there thinking that, you know, that really could have been a 10 to 12 to 14 point win. You know, if you take those field goals and some things change and, you really kind of win that game by, you know, double digits maybe. And, you know, and then what's the narrative then? But, you know, but the great thing about college football is, you know, at that level is you can play your way back into it. You know, if you do things right. And so they still have a chance. I would hope that Dan Lanning learned from that day, but I don't know, but I would hope he did.
Hey, thank you so much, Steve, for spending 30 minutes with us. We really appreciate it. Tell everybody where they can read your material these days.
Yeah, MagicCityImpact.com. Like I say, we cover UAB more extensively than anybody, and really have enjoyed our time there. And so that's where you can see our stuff.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Hello to your family and drive safely the rest of the way home. Appreciate it very much.
All right, Matt. Appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up, let's take a few minutes and talk some NASCAR, particularly another special weekend event that you can enjoy on Saturday. Brian Crichton, the president of Talladega Super Speedway, will be with us in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to Big Noon Sports.
Securing the best mortgage possible requires a lender who has knowledge, is trustworthy, and treats customers like family. And no one is better at all of this than the mortgage miracle worker, Haley Sansing. Based right here in Tuscaloosa, Haley Sansing has spent decades working in the mortgage industry. With Haley, it's personal, holding your hand from contract to close. With Haley, it's about one thing, you. Call Haley on her cell, yes, her cell, 205-792-1813. That's 205-792-1813. Let Haley help you.
NLMS number 230376.
WTBC Tuscaloosa and W265 CG Tuscaloosa, a Town Square Media station. Tide 100.9 and streaming on the Tide 100.9 app. From the Fox Sports Studios in Los Angeles, here's Nick Cope.
News in the NFL, Giants coach Brian Daboll announced rookie quarterback Tommy DeVito will start against the Cowboys this weekend, and veteran Matt Barkley, who is being signed to the active roster, will be the backup. DeVito becomes the 10th rookie QB to start a game this season, setting an NFL record. The Vikings opened the 21-day practice window for receiver Justin Jefferson. He's working his way back from a hamstring injury. The Cardinals opened the 21-day practice window for running back James Conner. He's missed the last four games with a knee injury. So there's a chance that Arizona will have both Connor and quarterback Kyler Murray available this weekend. For the Panthers on Thursday Night Football, receiver DJ Chark is doubtful with an elbow injury, and linebacker Brian Burns is out. He is in concussion protocol. Finally, to the NBA, where The Athletic reports that the league is discussing changing the NBA draft format from 1 to 2 days, beginning as soon as 2024.
This is the Big Noon Sports Network.
Hey, welcome back. We've gone through our halftime adjustments. Not that we needed it. It's Matt Coulter, Lars Anderson, Justin Jones, and now joined by the president of the Talladega Super Speedway, Brian Crichton. Brian, how are you today?
Matt, I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
It's terrific. It's like we're coming up on the spring race with the weather we've got here. I always love this event that you're having. I love the event that you're having on Saturday, and I think that there's going to just be a minimal chance of rain, but this is a great event. Go. But laps for charity, $50 donation, get you a lap at the Talladega Super Speedway. And I've done this with my children. I've done this with my grandchildren. It's just wonderful. And the deal, Brian, if it just the overall event and the chance to drive around that track in your own car, if that doesn't excite you and compel you to go, I can't explain exactly how much fun it is. Can you?
No, it's difficult to do, and that's why we encourage everybody to come out. Every single penny, the $50 donation that gets you three laps around the racetrack, every single penny goes to Toys for Tots this coming up Saturday. So we do this four times a year. It's been tremendously successful. Last year we raised over $50,000 for the four charities that benefited from it, and it's just great. You know, you cannot explain going around the racetrack on 33 degrees of banking on this massive super speedway until you do it. And once you do it, it's this aha moment of, you know, truly putting yourself in the driver's seat of what these NASCAR drivers do at 200 miles an hour with 39 other cars around you. It's pretty much insane.
Yeah, and one time I was in a golf cart with Tony Stewart, and he decided to, hey, we're gonna take it into the corner here, and you know, I don't know what the minimum speed has to be to make it without flipping over, but Tony barely maintained that, because when you are going through that banking, it's just like you're looking up Mount Everest. It is truly a spectacle. When was your first time around the track with a driver in one of the Cup cars?
So I've been around. I worked at Chicagoland Speedway. I've worked at Daytona, and obviously now Talladega. So I've been around each of them. You know, I try to limit my time in the passenger seat with a driver, because they like to absolutely scare the pants off of you.
Oh,
so
yes.
I'll always remember the time with Carl Edwards down at in Daytona. And by lap two, I was screaming to get out. You know, I like to have control of the car and holding onto that steering wheel and knowing what the car is doing. But it's been fun. I can't even imagine Tony Stewart in a golf cart at Talladega. And to answer your earlier question, it's kind of an urban legend, but in that golf cart, he's got to be going pretty good to you know, keep it on that track. But until you're going about 80 miles an hour, you're steering up the hill, because it's so steep, it wants to drag you back down towards the apron. And you're right, as you're coming towards turn one or coming towards turn three down that Alabama Gang super stretch, it looks like you're going towards the wall.
Yep. There's a building in the way. Yep.
There was another time I was with Tony, and he was in a rental car. We were on I-80 in Pennsylvania. Pocono was the next day, and he's like, hey man, watch this. And he gets the car up to like maybe 125 on I-80, and then there's an exit ramp, and he just throws on the emergency brake. And I swear, we skidded the whole way, and he got it to stop within about 3 inches in front of the stop sign. It was magic. I was just like, oh my gosh, this guy's incredible. And I know, like, Dale Jr. at Talladega, it was one of my friends that he was driving around, and he got so close to the wall that he clipped he rubbed the wall a little bit. He took the side mirror out. Yeah, because he was in a rental car. Yeah, he was in a rental car.
Oh,
he
yeah.
took the side mirror
me.
Out.
Yeah, yes. He did that to me,
you know,
too, and I was sitting in the front passenger. Go ahead, please. Brian.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Darlington has his Darlington stripe. Talladega's got the side mirror stripe going around Talladega. We've got a lot of drivers that have ripped that passenger side mirror off as they're taking laps around this track.
You know, Dale Jr. did that for charity, and it was to promote a local dealership. And he put a stripe on it. He took off the passenger side rearview mirror. And then it went back on the showroom floor, and I think it sold for more than it was listed. And he'll do that, especially if you know you think you know your business, and then he'll absolutely rattle your cage.
Oh, yeah. They probably had him sign the dashboard, and that also helped that sale value.
Brian.
Yeah, and Lars.
How'd you think?
Lars. Hey, Lars. whenever you're in a car with a driver and they say, watch this, you better go ahead and pull them belts tight.
Yeah, exactly. Pull them very, very tight. Gosh, I've got so many stories, and it's always fun until somebody gets hurt, but nobody ever did. Tell us a little bit for our listeners who may just be casual NASCAR fans about kind of the story of Ryan Blaney winning the NASCAR playoff championship.
Yeah, you know, obviously the 2023 season just ended this past week in Phoenix for the truck, the Xfinity, and the Cup Series. And, you know, Ryan Blaney, comes from a racing family. You know, his father, Dave Blaney, is a racer. And, you know, Ryan is a runner for Roger Penske. And so for Ryan to win this year, he won three races, Charlotte, as well as Martinsville and Talladega. So he won Talladega in October, and if you listen to his post-race interview, he really gave a lot of credit to the win at Talladega for really just giving his team the energy, giving his team the excitement just to continue on. And it wasn't necessarily a must-win situation, but obviously when you win at Talladega and that punches your ticket to that next round, it makes it a whole lot easier. So, Ryan is a big friend of Talladega Super Speedway, just a great, great person. Couldn't be happier for him. It was a very expensive win for me, only because my 14-year-old, that's his favorite driver. And so I've had to buy many diecasts and many T-shirts and hats now since he's the Cup Series champion.
And he's such a good young man. I was around him a lot when the race before back in the spring. He was inducted in the Davey Allison Texaco Coca-Cola Hall of Fame over there. And he was just so humble and polite. And I know, through talking to you and to Russell Brand, he's really good for Talladega. He really likes Talladega. He likes the people. He likes the fans. And for that reason, among many others, I was glad to see him win the championship. Brian, tough question for you, okay? I'm not going to get off the throttle. What happened with Chase Elliott this year, and what do you see in 2024?
I think that's the million-billion-dollar question of kind of what happened. You know, you go back to maybe his accident earlier in the year on the ski slopes with the snowboarding incident, and just maybe the team just never kind of gelled after that, after being out of the seat for a little while. But, you know, that's something for Chase and the Hendrick team, you know, really to expand on. He ran good at times, and other times it was just kind of a mystery. So we absolutely think Chase will be back. Chase, obviously is a wheel man, growing up, around racing his whole entire life. So we look forward to, Chase, and he considers, you know, Atlanta Motor Speedway as well as Talladega Super Speedway kind of his home tracks. And so, we're looking forward to Chase's return next year, and hopefully he'll stay up East Loops and, he'll punch another win here at Talladega.
You know, it's interesting to me just the balance of power in NASCAR among the teams. And for so many years when I was covering the sport, Hendrick Motorsports was the absolute gold standard. And now you have Team Penske, as you mentioned, Roger Penske, who's just a gem of a person. I love Roger Penske. Now they've won back-to-back titles with Joey Logano last year and Blaney this year, and also Ford this year swept all three series, right, with Cole Custer and Ben Rhodes winning in Fords. So just give us your analysis, kind of the state of the sport when it comes just to the teams.
Yeah, from a team perspective, I think that next-gen car that rolled out 2 years ago has really kind of leveled that playing field. As they used to say, money buys speed. But with these cars now, it kind of levels that playing field out. And so the teams can't invest too much money into it because a lot of the, different, parts of the car are, kind of standard and coming from, one manufacturer. So I think that's helped to level the field. That whole brand new car, and everybody's still learning it. You are seeing from last year to this year kind of those, more powerhouse teams, whether it's, Penske or Hendrick with William Byron winning six races, you know, they're kind of rising back up to the top just because of the, you know, probably all of the different assets and all the different people they have, personnel they have on those teams, are helping them figure out these new cars a little bit quicker. So I absolutely think that's done it. And there's just so many great drivers that are out there too, through all different ranks, that helps level that playing field too. But very, very competitive. Our ticket sales continue to be strong. So a lot of excitement in NASCAR right now.
Brian, before we let you go, tell everybody what to do, how to show up, and proceed with their $50 donation to Toys for Tots and their own personal car lap at Talladega.
Yeah, this Saturday from 9 in the morning until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, just come on out to Talladega Super Speedway. You can register in advance if you want to. Go to TalladegaSuperspeedway.com to register or for more information, or just show up. Take those three laps around, and if you have a couple of drivers that are in the car, we'll let you take another three laps around for another $50 donation. So every single penny goes to Toys for Tots to help kids in our area.
And you also get to wander around Big Bill's and all that where the TGE is, correct?
That's right. Talladega Garage Experience will be open. That's our $50 million renovation of our infield. It's got a game zone, a kids zone. Victory Lane will have one of our pace cars, as well as the Vulcan Trophy there for your, so you can take your pictures. It's going to be a great day.
It will. Thank you, Brian. Y'all do a super job.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
You bet.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian, hey, Crichton. Yep.
On the other side, I got to tell you the story about a NASCAR driver almost, or pretty much, flipping the Wienermobile when I was in it. And also the craziest betting line I have seen in maybe 20 years.
Yeah, anything involving betting and the Wienermobile is must listen to.
That's right.
We'll be right back with Big
Roll Tide.
Tide 100.9, Tuscaloosa weather. The weather unseasonably warm this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, the high 82. For tonight, mostly fair with a low at 59. Tomorrow, clouds gradually increasing. We'll have a chance of showers by tomorrow night, the daytime high 79. I'm James Spann on the ABC 3340 Weather Center on Tide 100.9. It's 81 degrees in Tuscaloosa.
Covering SEC sports like kudzu on the roadside. This is Big Noon Sports.
Thank you, James Spann, for weather report. Earlier when I said it was kind of getting crisp and fall again, I was wrong. It's now almost 80 degrees. So that will come this weekend, and hopefully, as he mentioned, with some rain. As Lars and I were driving back last night from Tuscaloosa, and you could see the smoke, and you could smell the fire from what was happening last night in Brookwood. Like 150 acres were on fire. It's one of 150 wildfires that we have in this state. Most, the large majority, are being contained. But folks, don't be careless with fire right now. Not any time, but particularly right now, because we haven't had rain in 2 weeks or so. And it doesn't take much to take kindling into a wildfire. So there's my little smoky bear mentioned for the day, Lars.
No, it's a tinderbox out there. So
also,
be extremely careful.
Also, we're probably driving about that area, that exit on 2059. And whose hauler passed us?
That's right.
Chase Elliott. Cool. It's kind of cool. All right. Now, what's this?
He was motoring too. He was motoring. he was digging to get back.
What a good looking.
I had always thought about, hey, you know, it'd make for a fun story if I ride, say, Charlotte to Fontana, right, all the way across the country with these guys. And then I was like, that requires way too much effort. I don't want to do that, so I better not pitch it. But one ride I did take was in the Wienermobile. And we all know what the Wienermobile is, right? Like, it's
Oscar Mayer,
and it's a big hot dog wiener wrapped in a bun. And so I don't even remember the sort of background details as to how I got to be riding shotgun in the Wienermobile with Kurt Busch, at Charlotte Motor Speedway. But, this was, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so. And I, you know, Kurt had a challenging relationship with, a lot of the people in the media, but for some reason we really got along very, very well. I respected the heck out of him because, Kurt was, he's so smart, you know, and he's just, he didn't care what people thought about him. You know, there's just something admirable about that. What was your relationship?
He didn't have Hendrick Motorsports behind him. Ran as an Indy a lot of his career, and he won a championship. But he's a very hard-nosed.
With Roush.
Okay, so that was probably the biggest team he ever raced for. But I didn't like the way he treated the media, because sometimes they just treat the media because they can. But he grew out of that, and then he let his little brother take over. But
We were supposed to, there's like an inner track at Charlotte Motor Speedway, and it's kind of like you start on the pit road, and then you just kind of do a circle around, and then you exit pit road, and you take a right, and then you go and you come back in on the back side of pit road. So anyway, that's what he was supposed to do, and you know, is again, it was just me and him for some reason, and he was like, nope, Lars, we're taking this baby out. So he got it going as fast as possible, and I look back, and you know, he didn't stay on the route that we were supposed to go. He went on to the main track, and we're cruising into turn one, and I see about 30 people with Oscar Mayer t-shirt, you know, their gear, running after Kurt. And I was saying, stop. I mean, because Kurt was determined to flip this thing in the corner. What he would really want to do, he wanted to get two wheels off the ground, and then try to, in the top two wheels, right, as we're going into turn one, and to see then if he could balance it through the corner. And he made it. No, he's nuts. I mean, these guys are nuts. These guys are nuts. Like, I don't know if you've ever just been, you know, like going from point A to point B with a NASCAR driver and in like a regular car. The speed limit, it doesn't exist.
Get tickets either, by the way.
They get out, yeah.
Especially
they get,
in North Carolina.
They get pulled
they go,
over.
Oh, hey, Kurt, no problem.
No, they get pulled over, but you're right. They don't get tickets, because they do things with cars. And I always said this, like, it was always a great challenge for me to, and I'm sure it is for you too, when you are calling a race, to try to make the race and like what makes a good race car driver, try to make that relatable to a stick and ball fan, right? And not someone who is extremely familiar with motorsports. And I always tried to use the idea that the car is almost an extension of their body, right? And they make it act and react as if it's a limb, and they have amazing hand eye foot coordination, and there's actually, you know, it sounds crazy to say with motorsports, but there's some poetry to what a really good NASCAR driver can do behind the wheel. And so anyway, Kurt got it, and he was able to get the top two off just for a little bit. And right when I thought we were about ready to, you know, topple over and maybe die, he got it back on the ground.
But what a way to go. How would that obituary read?
I know. There were a couple of times when, you know, I flew on with Tony Stewart and on his helicopter, on a helicopter, or on a jet, you know, with different drivers. And like, man, if this thing goes down, like in the New York Times story, I don't get mentioned until like the sixth paragraph. Have you ever thought that? Like, this is not the way I want to die. I'm an afterthought.
As long as we are literally going down this road, two quick stories. Richard Petty in North Carolina was once given a ticket because somebody was going slow in the left lane, and he didn't just tailgate him. He got up on him and gave him a bump at about 8 miles an hour. I mean, can you imagine being in that car? And also, in reference to your eye-hand coordination, they did some kind of a survey on different athletes and what they possessed. And one of them was about eyesight. And I think they got a couple of drivers. Darrell Waltrip was one of them. And he was the only one other than other NASCAR drivers that could do this. And they had them stand over a record player with a 45 on it, okay? No other athletes could read the label as it turned at 45 RPM except for NASCAR drivers. And that just gives you an idea, literally, of how focused they are.
That's really interesting. Yeah. One more question for you. Why is it you think that it's like age 42 is when you, or 41, you really see a dramatic diminishment of performance in the very elite of elite drivers? Dale Earnhardt Sr. was different because at age 50 he finished, or age 49 he finished second in the standings, and at age 50 is when he was going to try to become the first 50-year-old to ever win a championship, and that's when he passed away at Daytona. But is it a diminishment of the hand-eye foot coordination? So is it an athletic, or is it sort of like, you know what? I've hit the wall so many times. I know what it feels like. So I am not willing to put the nose of my car in a precarious situation that could end up with me hitting the wall at 150.
I think it's the same reason that you don't see quarterbacks at age 45, with the exception of a guy like Brady. I think your athleticism diminishes over time. That is what happens with the human race, whether you like it or not, whether I like it or not. But it happens, and that more than any other reason is why you see these guys, they get around 40 and they likely retire. Now, they'll still go out and run. Kenny Schrader's still running races, but they're on shorter tracks and feature events and that kind of stuff. So, all right, we did the NASCAR thing.
Yeah, I'd love to talk. This is good.
We could talk NASCAR. I got one more really good story about an RV at Talladega, and I'll share that with you. And then Lars is going to get into this Iowa Rutgers over under, which is just hard to understand. You're listening to Big Noon Sports.
Sports talk in Alabama. This is Big Noon Sports.
Welcome back in, Big Noon Sports.
I was getting coffee.
Sorry. All right, before we get to Robbie, who is called in, Matt, share your anecdote, your driving anecdote, your shit detail.
All right, this is about the guy that started it all. And I don't know if you ever had a chance to be around him, but I did, fortunately. Big Bill Sr., Bill France Sr., he started this all. He's the one that had the dream of bringing NASCAR to Talladega. But word is, when it first got surfaced, and, you know, they had some controversy about the asphalt, you know, the track itself coming apart. And the first race there, a lot of the big drivers like Richard Petty did not participate. But anyway, as the legend goes, and I think the most of this is factual, Bill France Sr. had his RV at Talladega, and he said, "I'll go show you if it's going to come apart. I'll take this RV around the track." And there were a couple of people in the RV himself. Of course, France was a racer. You know, he started on the beaches of Daytona. But he got that dang RV up to speed where he could go through the turns. And the guy that I heard this story from, I think it was from Bob Gambacurta, God rest his soul, he's one of my former partners. But he said that it was going so fast and it was at such an angle that he was afraid it was going to tip over. And who wouldn't? But you know, all those latches that batten down the hatches, literally, in an RV, so they don't come open while you're driving, so the dishes will stay in there. He said every dang one of them unsnapped. He said there were dishes flying everywhere. The TVs were coming off their hinges, and it was just an incredible deal. He did all that to prove a point. And that's the kind of guy Big Bill Sr. was.
Wow, I love that.
It's a great story. All right, 28.5. Tell me why that number is significant.
Well, before we go to that, let's go to Robbie Glenn, who All right. is called in, and former Alabama baseball player, part-time host of Big Noon Sports. Robbie, you hanging out at Rock and Roll Sushi?
Yep, hanging out here at one of our favorite places to eat, Rock and Roll Sushi in Hoover.
Awesome, man. And hey, you just sent me some amazing information about Striker Strong. First off, tell our listeners who may not be familiar with your son Striker and what Striker Strong is.
Yeah, Striker is my son and Lindsay's son. I said that kind of backwards, but you know. he was born with a rare syndrome, TBRS, Tappen-Brown-Rahman syndrome, and so he has he's been going through some experiences all through his life, and then at the age of 4 had a febrile seizure, what was very common, ended up throwing up and aspirating, and when he did, it stopped his heart, and now he has an anoxic brain injury. And so we have been dealing with that for 4.5 years and just trying to enjoy what we have with him. As you know, it's a lot of work. But we started a golf tournament a while ago when he was just diagnosed with a TBRS to raise money to help awareness and also get some funds for testing and everything to help out. And now we also do the tournament to help other local charities, other avenues, and also still help TBRS. And so we just got done with the golf tournament, well, a few months ago. We were able to cut a check for $25,000 to TBRS. To help with the research, we were able to help a Hoover school system here with some lifts and special needs equipment for their classrooms that deal with special needs kids that they needed. Also, Miracle League and Helena, we're going to cut a check for $5,000 to them, and also going to help with Alabama Veterans on Monday with their golf tournament and donate to them to help raise money for the veterans. So we're doing a lot of things with Striker Strong to help local and where we can. It's been really nice.
It's a cool thing, and especially in really like the involvement of Veterans Day. And hope everybody has more than a moment to appreciate what happens on Saturday, as we should celebrate 365 days a year. But Veterans Day is this weekend, so that is all cool.
It is. And so Veterans Day is very special to me. I got a very large military family, and I had just lost my uncle, who was a major in the Marines, and I lost him a couple months ago. And so, yes, I'm this veterans. I'm going to celebrate him and everything he meant to me in my life, and how he basically was like another father to me and raised me. So definitely going to help any way we can with these veterans. And this weekend, so get out and support your veterans, because they supported us all this time.
Robbie, Justin was just telling me about Alabama baseball getting cranked up here. You're obviously former Alabama baseball player. Just give us an update on what's going on with the Alabama baseball team.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, they're actually just finishing a great fall season. I was unfortunate. I couldn't, you know how hard it is for me to get to certain events, but you know, following them and keeping what they did against Auburn in their preseason game, and just how many home runs and how the pitching did. You know, they don't like to show final score, but it looked like they wore Auburn out pretty good. And then Florida State to come in, who is a national power always, year in and year out. And then I see how many home runs they hit against them and how the pitching did. So I'm assuming they did well. Now, they just wrapped up the Crimson and Gray, and I know it was 1-1, and I did not get to see yesterday how it ended, who was the came out on champ. But I'm looking forward to this year to see how they play. They got a lot of talent, apparently a lot of bats, and Vaughn's just come in there and got them excited. I do like the way Coach Vaughn has reached out to every former player in an email, text, or whatever he has done to get in touch with us and want us back to campus, get involved any way we can, and be a part of the team that is, we're like a family. And that's awesome for him to do that.
Hey, before we let you go, Robbie, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. If I have, I apologize because I don't remember. You played college baseball at Alabama, and then you played some minor league ball. Name a couple of few of the players that you faced that were on the diamond, you opposed or played with.
Well, I mean, of course, I'm going to name some of the guys I played with Frank Menichino and Joe Vitiello was some of the best players I ever played with. And Philip Doyle was one of the better ones, too, being short. But going against, I would probably have to say the best kid that I went against, he was a freshman at LSU when I was a senior. And I knew he was going to be good, and that was Todd Walker. That, something about the way he could play, he was phenomenal. And look what how long career he had. So Todd Walker was probably the one I went against that I thought was one of the best.
Anybody in the minors?
Alan Newman comes to mind. Chris Snopek was another one, played at Ole Miss. And I played against him in the minors. He played with the White Sox organization for a while.
He pitched.
He was a great one too. Went against Alex Fernandez, pitcher for the Marlins. I went against him in high school and in the minor one time. So
he threw a no-no in the bigs, didn't he?
Yeah, he was something. We had never seen something like that in my high school when we faced him. He went to Miami State, but I was Pensacola based, and we played in the state championship. And he threw something weird. Man, he was something back in high school.
Hey, Robbie, here's another random question for you. Who's the best batting practice player you've ever witnessed?
I'm gonna go ahead and say me, guys. I could knock them out of the park, and they get in the game. And I hit good for average. I just could not get it out of the park. And during the season, I hit like 6 or 7, but I would hit them out nonstop. But that's Bobby Pierce on me, good BP, I guess, Coach Bobby Pierce. But
talked about this earlier, which is really interesting. How the coaches they're not just throwing you certain pitches; they're just not throwing randomly. Like there's a process to the batting practice, right?
Well, I mean, there is, but the guys want to get in a groove. You're just basically when you're getting up there, they're going to keep throwing their same speed, kind of momentum, and you're kind of your first couple pitches. You're trying to go opposite field, a little hit and run. Do the job, get them over to third. Then you're going to do some scoring, kind of get in the outfield. And then you're going to kind of crank some up and get your free swings in, but you're still just going to groove them in there. You might have a pitcher that you're going to face that day with scouting reports that has some curveballs. So he might bend a couple to you in batting practice if you get used to it. But other than that, he's just going to groove in there and get your eye on the ball. You know, anybody can crank them out, but where can you hit the gaps outside pitch? Can you do a hit and run like you're supposed to?
So Robbie, you're a big golfer. Is there a similarity between being the champion on the driving range as being the champion of BP?
Yeah, something about a driving range, wide open, right? So you can just take a full swing, but then you get on the fairway, it's a little narrow, got some trees, got some houses, try and dial it in, or you got some water you got to clear. Yeah, it's a little different. It's a mental thing. So,
hey, Robbie. Great stuff.
But, hey, guys, I'll see y'all Friday. But also, is it not crazy that the year that we're going to have before we have the 12-team playoff, everybody's talking about this 4-team playoff because it's exciting? There's so many games to watch this week and next week of who's going to get in. Nobody would be watching Miami Florida State this week if it wasn't for a, if it was a 12 team, because they already know Florida State's in. This is going to be a fun weekend to watch.
Are you advocating for status quo?
Keep it at four?
Even though Alabama could be on the outside looking in?
They could be, but I mean, it makes it exciting. If they just keep winning, I mean, no telling what's going to happen. This makes it fun. Everyone's going to be watching to see what Washington does at Utah this week. No one would care if it was a 12 team because they're both in.
So, good point.
I don't know.
I think if you add 12, then you have the 13 through the 20 that are doing the same thing that we are now.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Do you know who wins overall? Awesome. You know who wins overall? TV.
Oh, TV. Oh, yeah, TV is going to be what?
Money.
Yeah, everybody's looking to watch Pac-12 and everything this weekend.
Robbie, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Robbie, great talking to you, Robbie. But Matt, that's a great point. Yeah. Would Alabama fans really be, would people in the South be as interested in what goes on with Washington and Oregon this weekend?
We haven't been before.
If it was an 18 playoff?
I don't know. But apparently we're going to see. Not this year. We'll see how 2023 bears out. We'll wrap up this Wednesday edition of Big Noon Sports with a big salute when we get back.
On the next Inside the Locker Room with Coach Wimp Sanderson and Barry Sanderson.
Tune in Thursday, 7:30. We'll talk with J.C. Sherbert. We'll go around the SEC, get his thoughts on the Alabama-Kentucky game. Also in the second hour, Deb will release his Blue Plate special. Currently 7-3. Can he stay hot?
Inside the Locker Room, weekdays 7 to 9 a.m. on Tide 100.9 and Tide100.9.com.
If you're a homeowner,
Tide 100.9, Tuscaloosa weather.
The weather unseasonably warm this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, the high 82. For tonight, mostly fair with a low at 59. Tomorrow, clouds gradually increasing. We'll have a chance of showers by tomorrow night, the daytime high 79. I'm James Spann of the ABC 3340 Weather Center on Tide 100.9. It's 81 degrees in Tuscaloosa.
From T-Town to the Plains, this is Alabama's most in-depth analysis on the SEC. This is Big Noon Sports.
Hey, thanks for tuning us in today, Big Noon Sports. And while we are carried by affiliates, well, first of all, Tide 100.9 and WTBC 1230 there in Tuscaloosa, others in East Alabama, our producer of this program for the last few months has been Justin Jones. And this is Justin's last day. And Lars and I just want to take a moment and just tell you how much we appreciate. Thank you for all you've done and what a real professional you have been early in your life. In a business that tries your nerves every single hour. But anyway, Justin, let it be said that you are going to be sorely missed.
I really appreciate it, guys. I think I've learned a lot in the time producing y'all's show, and I'm extremely thankful and learned a lot as well. I think I just said that. But the people we've gotten to talk to, as well as learning from both you and Lars, has been something I'll remember and cherish. It's been great.
You know, Justin, you and I go back a ways. You took one or two of my classes, I believe. And one of the first assignments I always ask people to do is favorite sports memory and then to write about that. So let's go back to that. Go back to the beginning. What is your favorite sports memory?
You know, you're right, and I'm having trouble remembering what I wrote about. I think the memory I wrote about was the second and 26. It's nothing fancy. It's nothing special. I mean, it's special in the sense that Alabama won the championship on the last play of the game. But it's my favorite memory because I got to spend it there with my dad in the living room. And growing up, as I've mentioned many times, my dad was in the military growing up, so he was often at work. He's been deployed several times. Finally having him home, though, and getting to watch Alabama football with him, and we were jumping, celebrating, just in our own house, in our own living room. That's one of my favorite sports moments.
And I actually remember the story. It sticks out to me. And Matt, it's really amazing when I ask students to do this, and Justin just so eloquently summarized his piece, is that they don't end up writing about sports. They end up writing about relationships and about, emotion and heart. And that is that's the magic to me, Matt, of sports right there.
I think that, there's a term that I hope still rings true today that's been used throughout my lifetime in just really quickly surmising what you think about a person. And it's, you were raised right. And I think that falls all over you, Justin. And you just explained it and detailed it by talking about your relationship with your father. Unfortunately, you don't hear that as often as you used to. But anyway, you were raised right. Go play golf with your dad and enjoy your time. And I think that there are really bright sunshines in your future.
Well, you know, speaking of my dad and golf, he actually ditched me this weekend. He went down to Tampa, driving down there today to go play in a memorial tournament down there with his friends from his old unit. So I'll have to hit the driving range this weekend and get some practice in before he comes back.
That's cool. So cool that I love talking to you about this, about you golfing with your dad, because me golfing with my 8-year-old son Lincoln is absolutely just the most cherished times of my life. And I'm doing a lot of research on Tom Brady right now, and Tom Brady's dad said to Tom, it was, they played in a father-son tournament, I think when Tom was 8, same age as my son, and Tom Brady Sr., he looked at Tommy, as they all still call him in the family, looked at him and said, "This is the greatest round I've ever played." And it had nothing to do with the score. It was the fact that they were playing together. And so I just learned this anecdote like 2 days ago. And just this last weekend, I looked at Lincoln, and I was his caddy daddy in a tournament. And after he drained a birdie putt on the last hole, I looked at him and said, "This is the greatest round of golf I've ever played." And I didn't even play. And so, it's universal of what sports can do to foster and build and nurture and uplift relationships.
And it doesn't have to be with just your dad. That's where you top. But I mean, you got two or three really good friends that enjoy their company. You go out and you play golf. It's just, it's a wonderful experience. And particularly with your father, I hope that everybody's had a chance to do that or something similar. So, being said, Justin, well wishes from Matt and Lars.
Of course, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. It's been a fun couple months.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we only have a couple of minutes. What's the deal with Rutgers in Iowa?
Rutgers in Iowa. Yeah. All right. It's going to be hard to summarize this in 2 minutes, but right now the over under, so total points scored in Iowa Rutgers is 28.5, which is the lowest over under in 30 years in college football. And there's a lot of reasons for this. Iowa is the 130th ranked offense in the country. They're just ahead of Akron, East Carolina, and Nevada. These two teams are 5-22. Iowa is the first Power 5 conference school to produce 250 yards of offense or less in 6 of its first 9 games. Ouch. The Hawkeyes right now, they're 7-2, and they lead the Big Ten West ahead of Nebraska, unbelievably. But here's the deal. Iowa, what did they do really well? They punt the ball. They have the best punter in like the last 10 years. His name's Torrey Taylor. And so they can't score, but they got a dude who can boom it like 55 yards every time. And here's the scary thing. Nebraska is on Iowa's schedule here coming up. I think it's the day after Thanksgiving. And Nebraska's, and of course everything circles around in Nebraska, Justin. That's why we got to finish it off this way. Nebraska's offense is so pathetic that this spread, the lowest over under in history, it may even go lower when Iowa plays Nebraska.
That's
bad. I think it's going to be an over under of like 27.
This Iowa team is one Gene Stallings would absolutely love. He'd like a little bit more offense, but a field position game, play it in the trenches. See you, Justin.
Love you, Justin.
Hot.